I happened to meet someone who has an incredible life experience of saving desperate refugees from a watery death just recently here at the radio. Actually, she's the mother of one of our collaborators, Miami-born Vanessa Greco, who works on the news desk. She was here to see her daughter. Vanessa had already mentioned her mom and what she does to me, so when she came to the radio, I jumped at the chance of speaking to her personally.
My name is Maite Greco. I was born in Cuba, and I came to the United States when I was 2 years old. My parents were very young, and it was at the time Castro had taken over. And they thought, let's go to the United States because everybody's going over there, and wait and see what happens, because I thank God every day that my dad had a little vision that maybe things wouldn't work out that great.
So you didn't go as a refugee?
When we left, they had some flights. And what Castro did was, you know, people that want to leave the country can. And he's done that over time. What happened was his real opposition said, okay, let's go to the United States. The only drawback was that you had to leave everything behind, just what you were wearing.
Maite told me that she grew up in Florida, where just 90 miles of shark-infested water separated her from a large family of Cuban relatives, family that to this day she has never met. But she said she grew up with a dream.
Since I was a little kid, I wanted to fly airplanes. Nobody in my family is a pilot. And coming from a Latin family, that's not something that you want your daughter to become. My mom, still to this day, she says, like, oh, you know, she wants to be a school teacher. I said, when I can't fly anymore, I will go back and teach people how to fly. For right now, I still fly. But I blame it on them, because I say, when I was very little, as far as I remember, you know, we come as immigrants. We didn't have a lot of money. We didn't have air conditioning. So my dad at night, he would take us for little rides in the car. And one of the places we go, either to the beach, get the ocean breeze, or to the airport, because it was out in the middle of nowhere, and it was beautiful, it was quiet, and the lights, and there's, you know, people love to go see the airplanes take off right. and land. Right. So I was fascinated, and I don't remember how old I was, you know, maybe four or five. All I remember are the little blue lights, and as I grew, I always loved the lights, and I always said, you know, as soon as I can, I want to learn how to fly. I was kept telling my parents that. They didn't think it was real. So the day I got my driver's license at 16, my parents said, you don't have to go to school. We'll go get your driver's license. And I said, great. And then, you know, they let me have the car. And what I did was I drove to the airport and I signed up for flying lessons.
And flying was to prove a lifelong passion. Maite told me that quite by chance, not long after she had got her flying license, she met a pilot named Jose Basulto.
We became friends right away. And we would fly. He had an airplane, and he would take me flying with him. And I loved it because, it, you know, he was very knowledgeable. He was very experienced and everything. This gentleman, actually, he was a veteran of the Bay of Pigs. In any case, that's where he got his training and things. And he loved to fly, too. And we loved to talk about flying, and we flew. So he tells me one day, I'm with him, and he says, you know, I have a friend. His name is Billy Shoes. And you know what he does? He loves boating, but what he does is he goes out on his boat and he looks for Cuban rafters. Now, a Cuban rafter is a person that actually gets really, literally on an inner tube. That's the classic. And he jumps on it. They study the currents a little bit. Right. And the summer currents, if you jump on it and float, it should bring you to the shores of the United States. That's real close to the southern tip of Florida. Mm-hmm. So he says, you know, on a boat, your vision is just a straight line, and a boat goes very slow. How about if we go on the airplane, next time that he goes out, and we'll circle him over the air, and we'll see if we see anybody. So we started doing that.
And that was to be the beginning of a mission destined to grow and grow. Although, Maite said, it took quite a while before they actually started to sight rafters.
And did you immediately start sighting rafters?
No, because we didn't We didn't know how to look for them, first of all. We were flying about 1,000 feet for safety. We're in a single-engine little Cessna. If you lose your engine, you're in the middle of the ocean. At 1,000 feet, you can't talk to anybody. There's no communication. You're on your own. So actually, we did the first day. The next time we went, we actually wore life jackets. We said, you know what? We fall at 1,000 feet. We don't have time to put life jackets. We started wearing our life jackets on. All right, and then we started taking a raft with us because it's like, oh, great, the plane will sink and we'll be like little dots, because we realized as we're seeing the crew, the boats, you know, the, all the fishermen, they're in very big yachts. And we realized these big yachts look like little dots in the water, very small. So we said, well, if we're going to spot a raft, which is a very tiny thing, we have to start flying very low. So now, well, we're flying very low. So, you know, precautions, we start taking flares because we realize, you know, if we go down, and it's something a pilot does when you're on a single engine airplane, you always think, if my engine goes away, what do I do? You know, you land it. So we're at the airport now, and we start leaving frequently. People see us leaving with our life jackets on and the flares, and then people say, like, where are you going? Why are you wearing your life jackets? Like, oh, we're going to do this. So then some flight instructors say, like, hey, can we sit in the back seat? Because, that you know, you pilots get experience sitting in the back seat. Now we're flying low over the water, something different. How cool. Can I bring my camera or whatever? So now we get, like, people that want to come with us. Now we have a lot of people want to come with us, and now we have a waiting list. And then the next thing, some of the instructors are saying, well, you know, they're building up hours always. Right. How about if we take students and build up hours like that? So now we're going like two airplanes at the same time. And it's like, great, because if something happens to me, I have another airplane. Well, the next thing you know, then we have four airplanes. And we're now like a really organized group, and we have found no rafts.
It was at this point that Jose Basulto, Maite Greco, and their companions founded a non-profit organization they called Brothers to the Rescue. All those who participated did so on a voluntary basis.
The first day that we went out as that group, and we're actually on the radio doing something, somebody spotted our first real raft. And because we were trying to get funds, we had media with us. We had camera people with us. And a boat spotted one. And we're like, I think six, we were like six airplanes out there and one helicopter. Everybody's so excited. We want to go see what it looks like. And on my way to find it, I found a raft. And that was my first one.
Without anyone on it?
Just no, a raft. This one had people on it.
You found a raft?
I found a raft with people. It actually was a canoe. And it had three people on it. And I, you know, since, remember, we don't know exactly what we're looking for here. I come down, we're in the middle of the ocean. And oh yes, that's small. That's, we're 500 feet for safety. And the camera guys start looking with the lens. They're like, oh yeah, they have no paddles. It's three guys looking on the boat. So we come into a very little low pass over it. And the man, he puts his hands over the two other, it was their sons. And then the next time we come to do another pass, he stands up and waves. And then he, you can see there's happiness in him. He's in the middle of the ocean. He'd been floating for 4 days. They have no food or water. His sons are all blistered up, pretty burned up from the sun. And, well, we keep circling him. We think we know what we're going to do when we find her off. We're going to circle because we can't land on the water. And then we've coordinated with the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard said, we'll pick them up.
The Miami Coast Guard.
Yes. Actually, they're based out of Key West. And they would be the ones to come. They come via helicopter, a Coast Guard cutter. And they would pick him up. So as we're circling this raft, I'm always going to the left because that's how I see, in very steep turns over a small point and circle. My cameraman, when you look for a camera lens, and these are things we learned through the years, like we tell the camera people, don't look through your lens only when you have to because you get very dizzy, you may get sick. One of the cameramen said, turn the other way. I don't feel so good. Turn the other way. As we turn the other way, we actually spot an inner tube with one young boy in it. He's 15 years old. And he's waving. Now, this is our first day we find these people. So, of course, we go where the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard took them to Key West. We landed in Key West.
So the Coast Guard
picked them up.
Did you wait for the Coast Guard?
Absolutely.
You wait.
Absolutely. Because they're so small. The Coast Guard would bring them to the United States, and because it's a communist country, they would be given political asylum right away. That changed when the Carter administration took over. And it changed to the point where if if we found a raft and we called the Coast Guard, they would be taken back to Cuba. They would be taken to a holding facility, and technically they would be taken back. Now, a lot of them were processed, and if they had families and sponsors and things, they were given an opportunity to come to the United States, but it was very slim.
Did you have any idea of how many people tried to raft across from
Cuba? Well, we had some statistics from the Coast Guard, and actually we did a lot of work doing that, because as the years went by and the time went by, we would have found the empty rafts. And pretty much the statistic says that out of every four vessels, it doesn't matter if it's an inner tube, a canoe, or a boat, only one will make it.
So out of four
people,
one makes it.
One person makes it.
How many people try to leave Cuba?
Thousands. Because we found thousands. I think personally I found over 300 in, you know, a few years span.
Between 1991 and 1996, the year in which Cuban MiGs shot down two of their planes, killing four pilots, Brothers to the Rescue conducted over 2,400 aerial search missions. These operations resulted in the rescue of more than 4,200 men, women and children, and in the rescue of thousands of others during the refugee crisis of 1994. In fact, reading on the internet, I discovered that it has been estimated that Brothers to the Rescue pilots have saved one life for every 2 hours of flight time. This is considered a record rate among professional search and rescue organizations.
I could go on for hours telling you of all the different things that I saw. We saw people getting eaten by a shark because we couldn't save them in time because their inner tubes were sinking, and you know, one would come off and that one was gone, and you know, and you have a brother losing a brother, and that's, I witnessed that situation and it was horrible. We would also drop supplies to them. One time we found a raft, and we would drop always water, a little sign, you know, welcome to the U.S., you're free. Yeah, something cute, a radio to find out their conditions. I mean, we got sophisticated over the years. But one time we dropped a bottle of water, and the water didn't land right on the raft, so they were so desperate. The youngest one on the boat, they were very ill on the boat already. He jumped out to get it, and when he jumped out, because they had one dead body on the raft, they couldn't let go of it. It was a family member. They did have the sharks around it. This little boy, he was swimming towards the water, and the shark was coming at him. So we started going down with the plane very low to see if the noise of the airplane would distract, but we're getting dangerously low to see if it would distract and throwing other things. He made it back onto the raft, and the Coast Guard that day was really close by with a helicopter, so they were airlifted right away. But the body, before the helicopter came, ended up falling in the water and they
disappeared.
Right, that's it. We saw things in the air, we saw things in the ocean, animals, creatures, and obviously the people. And what I was saying was, people came to build up ours, and when you save a life for the first time, you realize, like, oh my goodness, you know, I am hooked, I have to keep doing this. And sometimes we would fly and not find anybody on that day, because that would happen, and we say, if we had only one more hour, we can search a little bit more, or we find a lot, well, there's maybe more out there. It became really something that became part of our lives and who we were, the work that we were all doing. We're still a very close group. We've ceased to operate as a group, as an operation, but we became a very big family of hundreds of pilots that we were there. We're still very close because the things we witnessed were so amazing.